Victory or death!
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 Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. This is episode 21-15, the 15th episode of 2021. I'm your host, Hank Reardon, the voice of freedom, behind enemy lines, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, equipping patriots like you to stay in the fight to preserve your liberty. I'm going to talk about two different things today and then share with you another chapter of I Led Three Lives. The first is a letter from Gab, the Gab CEO. Gab's a alternative social media platform that's been blacklisted by the powers that be. This is titled, "The Vaccine Has Become a Religious Ceremony." In February, I explained the many reasons that the oligarchs fear Christianity. Their attacks on Christians started shortly after the mostly peaceful protest at the Capitol on January 6th. Suddenly, Christian nationalism was a threat to our democracy. Radicalized Christian nationalism is one of the biggest threats facing the U.S., wrote Business Insider. Give me a break. Their latest attack against Christians is the fact that many of us refuse to get jabbed with an experimental vaccine for a virus with a 99% survival rate among the vast majority of the population. White evangelical resistance is obstacle in vaccination effort, according to the New York Times. Christian nationalism is a barrier to mass vaccination against COVID-19, wrote the dimwits at the Conversation. These people love any excuse to demonize white people and Christianity. Meanwhile, the big tech overlords at Facebook are fact-checking posts from people who are dying from the vaccine. Mark Zuckerberg is also partnering with the government to socially shame those who decide not to get the experimental vaccine with vaccine-verified profiles. Since when is our medical history Facebook's business? The great irony here is that Zuckerberg himself isn't vaccinated. Yet. Maybe he just doesn't want to risk his skin peeling off in reaction to the COVID shot. I don't blame him. Risks aside, Christians also face a moral dilemma with regard to the fact that fetal cell lines played a vital role in the development of all three vaccines. Perhaps this is why the vaccine, like abortion, has become a de facto religious ceremony for the followers of the demonic critical theory religion that is sweeping Western society. Do you remember anyone ever virtue signaling online about getting a flu shot in the past? I sure don't. Suddenly it's cool and hip to let the entire world know about your medical history as a sign of your commitment to the cause of oligarchic tyranny. How utterly stupid and foolish. In other news, half of Americans support a vaccine passport, which means our society is rapidly fragmenting into two distinct economies. The economy of sane and rational people who do not want an experimental vaccine injected into their body, and those who handed over their bodily autonomy as a science experiment so things could go back to normal. Newsflash, things are never going back to normal, just like they didn't after 9/11. I'm going to come back to that. This is one of the many reasons I have been pushing Christians to start building their own economy, separate from all of this madness. Soon enough, we won't have any other choice. Ultimately, the oligarchs in power want us all worshiping the state, stuff, and science as God. God Almighty gets in the way of that. They want us enslaved to sin, to become even more spineless, docile, complacent, and obedient pigs. Christians and God stand in their way of total and complete control. The experimental vaccine isn't about health. It isn't about politics. It's about power. Power over your body. Power over your mind. Power over your soul. Resist. Keep the faith. We are children of God. After all, my body, my choice, right? Andrew Torba, CEO of Gab. Jesus is King. Don't you see this? I know you see this. This is funny because nobody sees this but us. I'm not getting that stuff. I've said it before. You can't convince me that this stuff is normal or safe or anything because we've never in the history of humanity ever until now created a vaccine for an RNA-based virus, ever. And now we created three? Come on. I don't care how much money you throw at a problem. I just don't care. That's nonsense. This is about money. They don't care. They're just injecting people. It doesn't work. It's dangerous. And what he says here, life isn't going back to normal. There's a sign on Home Depot as you walk in that says, masks required even if you've been vaccinated. Well, what the heck's the point of getting the vaccine?
Oh, to protect myself, right?
And every week, if you're on Gab, he sends out an email. They're all really good. And he's pretty much throwing it back in their face. Who knows, it won't be long till some trumped up charge is made against him so that they can toss him out of the way. Or maybe they'll destroy him like they destroyed Parler. Who knows? But it's like a cult, these people with the masks and the vaccines and everything. It's a cult. Cults are a religious thing. And next I'm going to talk about the ammo shortage. I'm on the hunt right now for data. It's hard to find. It used to be that you could pull up a company's prospectus. It's stock information. What makes them a company? What kind of money they're making? And the data was really easy to find. Well, I couldn't find what I was looking for today. But regards to ammo, majority of these companies are, all of these companies are publicly traded, which means they have to put out a prospectus, a report about their information and about what they make and how much they make of it and their competition and all these other things so that a prospective investor can look at this and go, oh, this is a good company and here's why. So Lake City, up until October of 2020, was run by a company called ATK, Orbital ATK. And it's a huge company. So let me just look at, let me pull up some of this stuff here about them. ATK Aerospace makes the Airbus A350, the Boeing 787, the Orion multipurpose crew vehicle, a space telescope, all kinds of stuff related to space. And ATK Defense ran the Lake City ammo plant. They made a anti-radiation guided missile. I didn't bother looking up what that was. Who cares? A missile approach warning system, precision guided stuff. The Bushmaster auto cannon, which is this big auto tracking cannon, 20 millimeter cannon. And I think they made a 30 millimeter cannon that you'd put on a ship or on a large vehicle. And also ATK Sporting. So they made a lot of sporting-related ammo. So it kind of works like this. Lake City, Federal, and American Eagle, which is Lake City ammo, they were manufacturing that at ATK for Vista Outdoor. Vista Outdoor makes CCI Blazer Spear Independence. Combined, if you take that as an entity, they make more ammo than all of the other producers of ammunition in the world. And Lake City makes all of the ammunition for the military and occasionally will sell it to outside people. So I'm hunting down some information here because as of now, this is interesting because ATK was the primary one responsible for shortages in the Obama years of ammunition. I know this because I ran an ammo company for over a year, and all the shortages that we experienced from a supply chain standpoint were created by them. They were creating all of it. Typically, it was primers. They would create primer shortages, and then nobody could get primers. They would create ammo shortages. You just cut supply, and under normal market conditions, you cut supply. When you're the largest producer of ammunition, if you cut supply 20%, you instantly see shortages. And they don't go away because you don't increase supply 20%. Now, ATK used to get its contracts renewed every 10 years. Then it was every 3 years. Then it was every year. And you're a company completely dependent on the U.S. government and the military-industrial complex. You do whatever they say. If they say cut supply 20%, you cut supply 20%. So ATK was running that company throughout from 2019 all the way to September of 2020. And I guarantee you whatever was in place at the time when Olean Winchester, the new running company of the Lake City plant, whatever was in place then continued on, at least, you know, temporarily. They didn't just fire everybody and say, okay, we're going to put all our Winchester people in here. No, they just took over the plant. The plant, Lake City, is run and owned by the federal government. Sorry, it's not run, but it's owned by the federal government. And they make from start to finish, they make everything. Small caliber. So they make a few other things, but typically 308, 223, 556, 9mm, basically NATO rounds. And then some of that is also made for other companies that buy it from them, Vista Outdoor being one of them. So ATK comes along and they say, we're gonna cut supply 40%. Well, then you see the shortages that we have now. Now, Vista Outdoor is also another company that has had lots of, let's say, questionable decisions in regards to firearms. They're not Second Amendment friendly, but they make a lot of Second Amendment products. What I mean by that is you've got bad people in places of control in that company. So if you want to shut down Patriots, how do you do it? Well, you take away their ammo. Now, you see it on the shelf? Is it ever on the shelf? Now, typically, an item, supply and demand, eventually price, goes up to a point where you can no longer hoard because you can't afford to hoard. And as a result, supply equalizes. But supply hasn't equalized. And this isn't just because the commies are out buying ammunition or that the new FUD that just bought his first gun and he's 30, 40, 50 years old, he needs like, what, 2,000 rounds? That's not happening. That guy doesn't know anything. He's trying to find a box, 50 rounds, 20 rounds, whatever. He gets a box. And then abracadabra, he's safe. So that's not it either. And people like me and you, we're not shooting. And if we are, we're shooting a lot less. I would normally go out on a range day, burn 250 to 500 rounds. Well, that's not happening now. Not at a dollar a round. And I reload. So no. So I'm shooting. I shot about 100 rounds last time I went out. And that was it. So we're not shooting. And it's never on the shelf. I'm going to go right now and look at this AmmoSeek.com. AmmoSeek is a search engine for ammunition. All right, I clicked on 223. And here's what I see. This is, I'm primarily looking for bulk ammo, just from a metric here. Red Army Standard, Wolf Performance, Tula, more Wolf. We've got some random remanufacture companies here. Some companies I've never heard of. Oh, hey, here's some PMC. Here's some remanufactured Freedom Munitions. More Red Army Standard. It's the only thing you see available anywhere. The Russian stuff or stuff made in Taiwan or whatever. Foreign country stuff. You're not seeing any of the American-made stuff. Why? Considering Lake City makes more ammo than every other producer of ammo. They make so many rounds, like 1.5 billion rounds a year, something crazy. Here's why I don't think they cut supply, not significantly, is there are no primers to be had anywhere of any kind at all. And primers are an overage of manufacturing. So if you're not producing it, you're still cranking these things out. You're still making them. And you don't want to stick them on a shelf. You want to get rid of these things as quick as you can. There's no primers anywhere. Now, you can find powder and you can find projectiles because reloaders aren't buying those things because you can't get primers. What the heck good is that junk going to do me? I don't care how high I stack it. I can't use that if I can't get primers. And the remanufacturers are going to start to have a problem pretty soon because people aren't shooting and they use that brass from the range and from military ranges. I called a army buddy of mine. He's an officer, and he is in a position where he's training soldiers. He said they're not shooting. Not to any real significant number. Not to what they were in, say, 2019 or 2018. So they're not consuming it. You and I aren't consuming it, so where's it going? I personally believe it's being produced. Now, I don't know the numbers. I have no boots on the ground at any of these places. So the Lake City plant, if you know anybody that's around there, what I'd love to know is, are they producing the same amount of rounds? If they are producing the same amount of rounds, where are they going? Because they're not making it to the market. They're getting stuck under some underground bunker somewhere? At $1 a round, most people are not hoarding. They might buy 1,000 rounds, $1,000 for ammunition. But they're not going to shoot it. They're going to sit on it. And they're going to wait. Police departments can't get ammo. Those guys already don't shoot enough. So they're not getting it. Used to be that you'd hear the police range cracking off rounds at least once or twice a month. I can't remember the last time I've heard that. So something fishy is going on in the ammo world. I'm still trying to run some stuff down. I want to get numbers and hard data. But you can look at a situation and you can go, this isn't adding up. Something's not right here. And that's where I'm at with this. I'm looking at this going, I used to be in this industry. And it's not adding up. Primers have always been volatile from a supply chain standpoint. But the rest of it, you would see some ebb and flow. These companies were back up to production levels. So either they're not producing it and they've cut supply. They're not producing it because their supply has been cut and they're having supply chain issues. So if you've got any contacts in the shipping industry, you could make me make some calls. I would like to know, specifically Lake City, where is the ammo going to? We have a lot of people that America supports throughout the world, NATO allies. Maybe it's going to them. Sure as heck isn't making it to the hands of patriots, and that should concern you. Because it impacts training. And because of that, I've looked at getting some alternatives, some laser systems, and even I have an airsoft rifle, but it's on the fritz, so I've been thinking about ordering a different one because I still want to train. Hard to do it $1 a round, and even worse, when you can't replace that round once you shot it, which is where we're at right now. I go to the ammo store. I go to the sporting goods stores regularly. Look on the shelf. There's nothing there. If you're seeing something different, hey, let me know. Go on to Podbean, leave a comment, shoot me an email. I'd love to know what you're seeing, but I'm not seeing anything different. Nothing's changed. It's been the same ammo desert here for a long time. Today's show sponsor is Acticare of the Blue Ridge, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. Acticare is in-home care for your senior loved one when you can't be there. Whether you're in Smith Mountain Lake, Bedford, Roanoke, Campbell, out in the country, give John and his staff a call. Get in touch with them, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge, and they will take good care of you and your family members. Next up, another chapter of I Led Three Lives. Getting down to the end here. We're almost to the trial. This is chapter 17, and what happens in this one is they go deeper underground, and that's because they tried to pass another anti-communist bill, and they all just freaked out. They tightened their cells. They put more division and separation between them. less cross work between the comrades. So take a listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Herbert A. Philbrick.
What is communism? I've been on the inside of communism. I still have contacts. From this knowledge, I tell you as simply and seriously as I know how. Communism is a lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, murderous, determined, as J. Edgar Hoover says, a criminal conspiracy. I'm choosing these words deliberately. Lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, determined, an international criminal conspiracy. This is the true nature of the enemy. This is communism.
Chapter 17, Deeper Underground. In Boston, there is an organization known as the 20th Century Association, considered a respectable non-communist group with a 75-year history in the community. It is an organization literally supported and backed by Boston's best families. On March 25, 1947, at No. 3 Joyce Street in Boston, Philip Jaffe and Julian Friedman gave a report on China and on China's people today. Jaffe, at one time editor and owner of the magazine AmerAsia, was arrested by the FBI in 1945 for unauthorized possession of defense data, but was later acquitted. Luis Lyons, formerly of the Boston Globe and later curator of the Nyman Foundation of Journalism at Harvard University, was the chairman for the evening. What Lyons and those present did not know was that arrangements for the meeting had been made through the subtle influence of two pro-group members, one of them also a member of the association. Dirk Jan Struick, professor of mathematics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and secret member of the Communist Party, also assisted in the project, and the speakers were obtained from Maud Russell's Committee for a Democratic Fair Eastern Policy, an organization listed by the United States Attorney General as subversive. Neither did they recognize that the Friedman-Jaffe appearance represented but one small tentacle of a vast, interlocking, international network of communists and pro-communists whose sole purpose was to see that China would be totally and permanently controlled by a communist dictatorship. Philip Jacob Jaffe, Russian-born, alias John Phillips and J.W. Phillips, was a wealthy printer of greeting cards and the editor and owner of the magazine AmerAsia. His specialty was the trafficking of highly classified U.S. government documents, literally by the hundreds, from such sensitive areas as the State Department, OSS, predecessor of the CIA, and both Army and Navy intelligence, and the publishing and distribution of violently anti-free China propaganda. Jaffe functioned behind any number of fronts, including the American League for Peace and Democracy, the National Council for American-Soviet Friendship, and others. The purpose of the Friedman-Jaffe appearance was to use the 20th Century Association as a transmission belt to convey propaganda which would tend to strengthen the Soviet international communist movement and to weaken the position of the United States and the free world. The front is the stock outlet for pro-group operations. The fronts which we used were of four general types, with many degrees of shading between them. Failure to distinguish between these groups and to understand the Communist Party's methods and aims is one of the greatest weaknesses of the anti-communist forces and a source of many injustices. Blanket condemnations which indiscriminately blacklist the entire membership of organizations which have been infiltrated, used, or even controlled by communists can harm innocent persons. Every precaution should be taken to distinguish between the innocent dupe and the conspiratorial communist, between the victim and the vulture. Guilt by association merely strengthens the hand of agitators in their attacks against alleged infringements of civil liberties. Over 300 young people in Cambridge, Massachusetts joined the Cambridge Youth Council. The organization was later cited as a communist front group, which indeed it was, but the youth who joined the CYC had no knowledge that the organization was controlled, lock, stock, and mimeograph machine by the Communist Party. Of the four general types of fronts, first there is the communist front that has been planned as such from its inception. The Civil Rights Congress is an example. This type of front is conceived and directed by communists and operates behind a screen of apparently respectable pro-group members. Non-communist organizations and individuals are drawn into the front in response to its name and its statements of purpose. Even though it is heavily disguised, its basic aims will normally coincide with the Communist Party line. No matter who the innocent sponsors may be, a careful examination of its platform for comparison with party declarations will usually unmask it as a communist front. It may be drawn around specific issues with which many liberal-minded persons are inclined to agree, but communist-leading such groups usually permit one issue to run into another, until inevitably they tip their hand to the clever observer and reveal their support of the whole communist platform. The second type of front is the coalition, in which the party openly joins hands with the organization, communist or non-communist. The Progressive Party is a typical example. In the 1948 elections, there were many liberal and independent voters who felt, in all sincerity, that they could not support either of the two major parties. They also felt that the Progressive Party was a noble experiment in cooperation with the communists. They soon discovered that such cooperation is an idle dream. The communists took over the Progressive Party entirely, and later made a shambles out of the campaign and a fool of Mr. Wallace. It is a tragic fact that countless loyal Americans were caught in a trap when the Progressive Party was later cited as subversive by the U.S. Attorney General. There is a third type of front which is based on an organization representative of humanitarian, non-communist interests, but infiltrated by undercover communists in a deliberate campaign to seize control and turn the group to their own purposes. Boston's Youth for Victory group was one example, and on the national level, the American Youth Congress was another. Often, after seizing and using the group, the comrades will find that they have no further purpose for the organization and will suddenly withdraw their support and their workers. The organization, by this time dyed a deep red and in public disrepute, then collapses. In the fourth type of front, infiltration is also involved. But here the communists use an organization as a refuge and a badge of respectability to conceal their underground activities. Countless associations and committees with spotless records harbor a few communists without ever knowing it. I knew communists in the Advertising Club of Boston who would point to the organization with pride in public and scoff at it in party meetings. Usually the communist does not work actively inside this type of organization, but uses it as a credential to worm his way into other organizations. To the top pro-group operators, this fourth type of front is the most important of all. At the time I joined the pro-group, one of the most active fronts in Boston was the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. It was a favorite fundraising project of the party, playing with elaborate virtuosity upon the sympathies of ordinary citizens for the victims of the defeated fascist armies. The list of sponsors of the group revealed a remarkable absence of known Communist Party members, which would make it appear that the communists had been deliberately blackballed. But the secret pro-group communists pulled all the levers that controlled the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee. They appeared as initial sponsors, thus giving the front an air of respectability. They approached other well-known citizens of Boston's community and enlisted their support and the use of their names and their money. They staged elaborate benefits for which the arrangements, including the sponsorship, were all worked out in pro-for meetings. One of these, I recall, was a benefit motion picture, Man's Hope. Another was a personal appearance and speech by O. John Rogue. In our pro-cell, we arranged for the hiring of an auditorium, in this case, the New England Mutual Hall. We assigned comrades to work on sponsors. Their orders were to obtain the very best, most respectable people. Among those who were successfully taken in for this type of fundraising dodge were Judge Jeanine Leutman Barron, Dr. Channing Frothingham, Rabbi Joshua Loth Liebman, and dozens of other noted Bostonians. Using this formula over and over again, garnishing it with speakers who were brought in through the efforts of pro-cell members, the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee was able to raise tremendous sums of money in Boston alone. Only after considerable public pressure did some of the Boston Blue Bloods disown the organization, and then, for good measure, some of the pro-group communists publicly disowned it too. Secure as the pro-organization seemed to be, it was not invulnerable. In November 1947, we were given a scare. To a meeting at Norma's one night came a militaristic young man, Pete, the courier, our liaison agent with the district party headquarters. He bore an important message from the leadership. Pete looked the part of a courier. He had close, cropped hair, which gave him a Prussian air, and the effect was enhanced by a belted trench coat. His visits were always brief. He never addressed anyone in the cell by name, even by first name. His suggestions were accepted by us as party directives. On this particular night, he addressed us on the subject of security and gave us a list of security precautions. The primary concern, he said, was the protection of the pro group as a whole, even to the sacrifice of an individual member. He reiterated the order that no member of the group should go to the district office for any reason. He told us not to telephone the state office, but if we had messages, to route them through the cell chairman, who, I later learned, relayed them through Jan, the head of the all-powerful pro-council. We were to exercise extreme caution in any contacts with each other outside of cell meetings. It was advisable, he suggested, not to meet in each other's homes privately, but to confine ourselves instead to public places such as restaurants. Pete cautioned us against the keeping of records or the listing of any names. He ordered us to spread out our cell meetings by shifting their location from one member's home to another, and advised us especially to avoid holding successive meetings on the same day of the week. A variable pattern is the first requirement of security. Accordingly, we met one week on Wednesday night at one apartment, then on Friday somewhere else, and even shifted the hour of the gatherings to avoid a rigid pattern. Not long after Pete's security lecture, the party took a swift dive for cover. The cause of the flurry was a warning from O. John Rogue, former U.S. Assistant Attorney General. He said that his ex-boss, Attorney General Tom Clark, was preparing to use a New York grand jury investigation on subversive activities as a springboard for launching of a new series of raids against the Communist Party. Rogue said they would duplicate the notorious Palmer raids of the 1920s and that the government's witch hunt would be marked by midnight roundups of party leaders, seizure of records and documents, and a framed plot against the Communist Party reminiscent of Hitler's carefully staged Reichstag fire. The top brass scrambled for cover. District leaders fled the little building headquarters and ran into hiding out of the city, taking the party's important records with them. The tip-off said that the raids would take place November 15th. It was not until several days after that date that the party relaxed its vigilance and sheepishly emerged from the bushes. No one ever explained this raid, which did not come off. The party crowed about its security system and took credit for upsetting the government's plans. But I, for one, was never convinced that any such raid was planned in the first place. The Palmer raid scare brought new tension into the party. We avoided the telephone. Notices of cell meetings became friendly invitations such as, "Dear H, I'm having a few people in Wednesday evening at 8. Hope to see you then. N." There was no address and no names were used. Despite regulations to the contrary, it was necessary for me to work through the district headquarters from time to time, because of my specialty in the preparation of leaflets and propaganda material for the District Education Commission. An exception to the rule was made in my case, but they were the most covert operations. If there was material for me to pick up, a rendezvous was arranged at a busy soda fountain. I purchased a copy of the Boston Globe, entered the drugstore, and took a stool next to a communist courier, who had a copy of the Globe on the counter beside him. I placed my paper next to his, and after a brief interval, he picked up my copy and departed. When I finished my coffee, I took the remaining Globe, the folds of which later yielded the source of material for a party pamphlet or flyer, together with instructions for turning it out. When it was necessary for me to take the bundles of completed material to party headquarters, no contact was necessary. I carried my work to the Boylston Street subway and stuffed it into a parcel locker. Then I inserted a key in an envelope addressed to the headquarters and dropped it in the mail. The headquarters workers took the key, entered the subway station by a tunnel running under Boylston Street, and retrieved the material without ever going above ground. With the new vilification directed against the FBI for its supposed part in the Tom Clark Reichstag plot, I found cell meetings to be more and more of a strain on my nerves. I began to lose my appetite and frequently went to meetings without dinner. I became acutely aware of my dual personality and the necessity of preventing one from infringing on the other. Driving off to a meeting after a busy day at the office, I would pull the car over to the curb and settle back for a few minutes to shift my mentality into Marxist high gear. I scanned the textbook for the evening's educational meeting, absorbing the rude terminology and bludgeon phrases to tighten my discipline and prepare myself for the shocks that I knew would come. One such shock was the appearance at a meeting of my old friend, the charming Martha Fletcher. I knew Martha as a fellow traveler from the old days of the AYD. To walk in and find her in a pro-cell meeting was in itself no great shock. I was prepared by this time to encounter anyone there. But then came a cell meeting, one snowy night at Martha's Grove Street apartment on Beacon Hill. I remember distinctly a small triangular room at the very rear of the apartment, with an office desk in the middle, and a white porcelain oil stove beside the desk. There was a china closet in one corner of the triangle, a sofa in the other corner, and a wooden window seat in the third. A table held a small aquarium with tropical fish, one of them a cannibal, Martha said, which had to be kept in a separate compartment of the tank, or it would devour the others. Outside the apartment, elevated trains crossed the bridge from Cambridge and dived into the tunnel under Beacon Hill with a roar that forced us to suspend conversation momentarily. Martha sat behind the desk, the center of attraction, poised, calm, and efficient, directing the meeting with the vibrancy of her youth. It was my assignment that evening to lead the discussion, which centered on an article in a recent issue of the Common Form Bulletin dealing with the intensification of party discipline and action, and especially with the employment of civil disobedience as a primary weapon. The article said that it was impossible for communists to display an excess of zeal in the pursuit of communist aims. I had marked out the important sections of the document for discussion, and had prepared a list of supplementary questions to provoke comments from the membership. It was intended to be an inspirational discussion, but I observed in Martha a growing impatience. She glanced at me frequently, and her charming features hardened. Apparently, my conduct of the discussion was too thin for Martha's blood. Her customary warmth vanished, her voice lost its softness, her eyes glinted with irritation and impatience. "This lacks specific objectives," she said harshly. "The time has come when we must be realistic. Civil disobedience is nothing new in American history. There are opportunities for it on all sides. We communists must be vigilant to support incidents of civil disobedience wherever we find them, and to initiate them where necessary." Martha's attack was a vicious rebuke to me. I made no effort to regain the floor. She called up the memories of Crispus Attucks and John Brown. She raged against Henry Wallace as a social reformer and an idle dreamer. This is another example of party duplicity in politics. The communists, and even Martha, were supporting the Wallace campaign in the open, while deriding him behind his back. Martha raged against the liberals, the privileged workers and petty bourgeoisie who stress class collaboration and object to revolutionary struggle. She told us that we must be prepared for civil disobedience, which would turn to revolt if a severe economic crisis struck the country, or if the capitalist world embarked on an imperialist war, which could be converted into a civil war. The alarming demonstration of party fervor put on by this attractive young girl lapsed into an impromptu quotation from Stalin, which carried her to even greater heights of ardor. "Furthermore," she said, and I passed on her exact words to Don Richards, "we should arm the workers for it, and we should arm them now." It was this firebrand, ostensibly a young leader in the Unitarian Church in Massachusetts, an associate director of the American Unitarian Youth, a fiery campaigner for the Progressive Party, and a diligent worker in many other organizations, a brilliant, persuasive, and bewitching young woman who became the chairman of our pro-cell. To hear her speak with such vehemence unnerved me to the extent that, when I reached home that night, I could not sleep. I went to my hideaway, which in the Melrose house was concealed in an old coal bin in the cellar, and labored until early morning over a long report for Don Richards. "Does she know what she's talking about?" I asked in a rambling digression, and the words on the paper reflected my confused thoughts. Did Martha realize that revolutions carried out by bands of armed workers, as she called them, meant bloodshed and destruction, and a final denial of all Christian principles? After the conclusion of our studies on the state and revolution, Professor Dirk Struick of MIT came to a meeting at Peg Gilbert's in Cambridge to give us a summation. In a two-hour talk, Dr. Struick analyzed the conditions for socialism and revolution in almost every nation of the world. Some areas, he said, were overripe. One of these was Indonesia, where civil strife was even then in progress. It was another shock to me, another imponderable, when I heard this tall, lanky Dutchman, a naturalized citizen of the United States, a brilliant mathematician, and keen Marxist student, urge all communists everywhere to support their Indonesian comrades by every means possible in their civil uprising, a revolt directed against his own native land. Martha Fletcher and Dirk Struik set the militant tone of the meetings in those early spring days of 1948. Events seemed to be moving swiftly towards a climax. One eventuality was the possible passage of the Mundt-Nixon Bill, then up for consideration in Congress, which would have outlawed the Communist Party. It brought Pete the Courier back to our cell with drastic security orders. We were to be broken down organizationally into groups of no more than 5 members, Pete explained. There was to be a solid wall of security around each cell. We were never to mention in our cell the name of any member of any other cell. Personal or business telephones were never to be used for calls to other cell members. Pay stations were permissible, but we were cautioned that the phone at the other end of the line might be tapped. All written notices of meetings were banned. Our meetings were arranged with details of time and place in advance from one session to the next. The breakdown of the party hit the pro group hard and hampered my efforts to gather intelligence. We were split into smaller cells, which henceforth never contained more than 5 members. The regular ranks of the party drew up a similar organizational plan, but it was not put into effect until later. Our units were scattered throughout the Boston area, out of touch with each other, except through the new administrative structure. The chairman of each cell in the pro group served as a member of the pro sub-council, on which no more than 5 cells were represented. The sub-council, in turn, sent a single delegate to the pro-council, the governing body of the entire pro-group. It was this council which maintained direct links first to the National Party headquarters in New York and next to the district headquarters. However well-intentioned the Mundt-Nixon proposals may have been, they were greeted with the same hoots of derision in the party as usual accompanies any anti-communist blast from Congress. Boone Shermer said, "It's good. They make us appear even stronger than we really are. For those of us trying to do a careful job of fighting communists from inside the party, the mass hysteria that seized the nation was a heavy blow." Although security restrictions had been tight before, it had been possible to move around with comparative freedom and learn what was going on. But the new party breakdown that followed introduction of the control legislation vastly multiplied the difficulties of my intelligence work. Luckily, I had already drawn up a fairly complete picture of the pro group and its membership for the Bureau. After the breakdown, it would have been almost impossible to get it. I was close to a number of ardent communists in a larger cell, but I lost track of them after the group was split up, and I seldom knew thereafter what they were doing. It was for reasons such as these that the FBI, including Director J. Edgar Hoover, publicly opposed outlawing the Communist Party. Many people felt it would merely drive them underground and make them all the more dangerous and elusive. It was in the midst of these new security maneuvers that the party was dealt a severe blow. On July 20, 1948, the federal grand jury in New York slapped conspiracy indictments on the 12 top leaders of the Communist Party, including Chairman William Z. Foster. Horror and outrage spread through the ranks, but it was not long before the party, rising to the challenge, purged its own jitters and restored its confidence. Rallies were held to denounce the Smith Act, under which the 12 were charged. Pamphlets, leaflets, newspaper and magazine articles, compiled with the assistance of the best legal minds in the party, set out to convince the American people of the innocence of the victims. There was arrogance in their tone. They defied the law, the courts, and the Justice Department. They swiftly and efficiently organized campaigns for funds for the defense of the 12. The entire energies of the party were directed toward the trial. In the meantime, an emergency mobilization plan was organized in case the party had to go entirely underground. In Boston, the system was given 2 trials in the pro group and regular party cells. The plan was designed so that all members could be rallied at a moment's notice in a predetermined location. The 2 practice mobilizations were held in July and August 1948, and they demonstrated the efficiency of the new administrative setup throughout the party. Warnings were flashed, for example, from headquarters to the chairman of the pro-council, who notified the other members of the group. The notification, by courier or code telephone call, was in the form of an innocuous message, such as, "Aunt Martha is sick, can you come over?" Each pro-council delegate flashed the word to his sub-council, and the five members of the group passed it along to their cells. By virtue of the new organization, each leader at every level was responsible for no more than five others, and the alert was thus passed quickly down through the ranks. From that time on, each cell in the party maintained a standard mobilization procedure with a pre-designated rallying point, a recognized warning code, and a tight system of communications. It was the beginning of an underground organization, which has been constantly polished and perfected since. Shortly after the indictments, I received a telephone call one day at the office from Don Richards. "Can you duck out for a minute?" he asked. "Sure." I grabbed my hat and told my assistant, Eddie Alfano, I had to go down to the bank. "Can you cash a check for me?" he asked. "Save me a trip." I told him I would, and I waited while he endorsed the check. Then I dashed out of the office. 15 minutes later, I was seated at Don's two-door jalopy, a wreck of a car whose exterior appearance belied its high-speed engine and its well-equipped interior. We parked on an esplanade along the Charles River near the Hatch Memorial Shell. "What's doing?" Richards asked. "Nothing new. Routine. Mostly trial stuff. Civil rights, that sort of thing. The comrades are screaming about the 12. "What do you know about the indictments and the 12? Richards asked. "Quite a bit. That's all we've talked about." Richards looked straight ahead of him, through the windshield, his eyes wandering into the distance. He was silent for a long minute. "I have instructions to make an inquiry of you," Don said. It was not his normal manner of approaching a subject. "Anything I can do, you know. This might not be easy. The Justice Department wants to know if you might be willing, would volunteer, to appear as a government witness at the trial of the 12. They want you to tell your whole story." All right, so he talks about a couple different things there, about specifically the different types of groups that you have within the communist organizations. We've pretty much seen all of these throughout the book. Four general types of fronts, he called them. So you've got the ones that have been planned from the beginning. You've got a coalition, which is a bunch of groups with communists and non-communists and progressives, and they're all communists. You've got the third is a one that's all humanitarian non-communists, but infiltrated by undercover communists. And the fourth type is infiltration is also involved, but here the communists use an organization as a refuge and a badge of respectability to conceal their underground activities. So this one, there's no communist tendency whatsoever. They do everything they can to be, "Wait a minute, he's a member of that. He would never be that if he's a communist." So they use it to be a shield to protect their communist sympathies and identities. And so at the end of this chapter, he gets asked if he's ready to testify. This has been a long road for him, and now the trial is almost here. So we're getting down to the wire. I think there's three more chapters and an epilogue, and then that'll be it. So as promised, here's your second show for the weekend. So staying on track here for a show a week, so that's pretty good. Make sure you tell your friends about Radio Free Virginia. I'm hoping to have my t-shirt section of the store up and running within the next 2 weeks. I've got the first shirt design done, got it integrated with the website. Now I got to deal with payment stuff and all that technical stuff, but it's moving along. Well, thank you for listening. Remember, you were not made to fit in, you were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.